We will now have the sermon by our pastor, Mr. Salyer. If you've been reading the Bible reading program and keeping up, as some of you have just finished the book of Job and have returned to the middle of the book of Genesis. By its nature, the Bible reading program does not include expounding the material or drawing out particular lessons from it. That's for the reader to do. This is specifically a Bible reading program, not a Bible course or a Bible study program. You've probably learned many things from reading so far in the book of Genesis as well as the book of Job. And you may also have been stymied from time to time by what does this mean? Or what am I supposed to learn from this? Or what does this passage mean? I don't quite understand where this is going. I think we all have been reading our Bibles long enough and studying them long enough to know that's pretty normal. We get into the Bible and we read something and we stop and say, what? And we go back and try to figure it out. And then we start looking for other places that might explain what we just read. Or we might even go back and try to find something that the church has written about what it means. And occasionally we'll go to maybe a commentary or a resource of some sort to see if we can figure it out. Now, I, for one, am always cautious about that, and I'll mention that here because I don't have any problem with going to sources for language, for history, for geography, for, you know, some of the facts about the culture and those things. But I'm really personally very cautious about going to such books to look for what I call spiritual interpretations or spiritual lessons or analogies, because very rarely do people who do not know the truth know how to draw out something from the scriptures and teach us. Now, we need to be humble enough to be teachable, of course, but spiritual teaching is supposed to come from God through his church and through his ministry, and so I personally don't go to look to see what, and I could mention names here, but I won't, certain doctors or preachers or teachers from television or from books or whatever have to tell me about what the Bible means. I do go there from time to time, especially in a place like the book of Job, which I find fascinating and mentioned a couple of weeks ago, to find out things that they might be able to discern by research or by historical information that I might not have at my disposal. In the sermon today, I'm not going to try to explain the details of the book of Job, but I would like to highlight three primary lessons that we learn from this book, and you may have learned others that you would consider even more primary, but I consider them generally the primary lessons from this book, and not only from the book, but from Job himself, who no doubt is the author of the book under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, and we'll talk about that. The book bears his name, and we're quite confident that he, in fact, wrote it, and we do call him, in that sense, a prophet, though his book is contained in the wisdom literature in terms of the categorizations of the Old Testament. The three lessons, and we'll come back to these, the three lessons are, number one, Satan has tremendous but limited power over man. Satan has tremendous but limited power over man. Lesson number two, self-righteousness prevents full understanding of God. Self-righteousness prevents full understanding of God. And number three, God is always in control and is perfectly just. God is always in control and is perfectly just. Now, again, while I do not trust scholars generally to give me spiritual understanding, I do trust some of their research into facts and figures. Usually you can trust their conclusions on matters like geography or even genealogies, and for the most part, even chronology. In other words, those physical features that help us to understand the context of what we are reading so that we might draw something more out of it spiritually, or just find it more interesting. And I sometimes have questions when I'm reading that I like to try to track down. Job, for example, if we go to the book of Job, chapter 1, and we'll just be touching on a few of the portions of Job as we go through here. If we go to Job, chapter 1, verse Always a good idea to begin at the beginning. Job chapter 1, verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. So the book starts with a location that I'd like to know. I can't say that I do, but I can say that I have looked at it and studied it and tried to figure it out with the help of those people who think they do know. And they have good reason to think they know in one sense, because they are careful to parse the language, as we would say, and come up with hints here and there and bits and pieces of things that they think might help them discern that. This word Uz is actually used in several places in the Bible. I think it's seven in different parts of Genesis and Job. The land of Uz, I actually think it's even in a couple of other places in the scripture. They don't give us any exact location, but they give us some hints. For example, if we go to 1 Chronicles chapter 1, and look at verse 17, it says, "The sons of Shem were Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, Aram, Uz, Hul, Gether, and Meshech." And they may be pronounced a little differently than we would pronounce them in our English phonetics. But one of the sons of Shem, who of course came through the flood, is Uz. Now there are other Uzes mentioned, even all the way down into the genealogy of Abraham, but we have good reason to believe that if the place called Uz is named after the man, which generally they are, as you know, as this town is called Houston, I don't know who Mr. Pear was that Pearland's named after, but yeah, right, thanks. But Houston is named after a man. Most of our cities and towns and counties and so forth are named after people. If Uz was named after a man, it was probably named after this man, as I will show you in a minute with some of the very thin context for that purpose. There were later men named Uz, as I said, but this is the most likely source of the name of the place. Back to the book of Job. So remember here, this is one of the children of Shem, and Shem, of course, is at the time of the flood and thereafter. That's why the genealogy here comes through him. Job again, chapter 1. Times like this, I wish my pages weren't so thin, but I don't like carrying around a big heavy one either. Job chapter 1, verse 3. Talking about Job's sons and daughters and then his possessions in verse 3. And near the end of the verse it says, "So that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East." All the people of the East. Now again, you could count the East, I suppose, in several different ways. But the terminology and the language seems to indicate, based on the word and based on the internal evidence of the book, that we're talking about something northeast of Palestine. Something up in the upper Arabian desert that would probably be near the Euphrates River, and therefore perhaps something in the area of Iraq and Turkey, and not all that far, in fact, from where Abram came out of Ur of the Chaldees a little later. Probably a little later. I'm personally convinced it was a little later, though the scholars don't necessarily agree with that. They think he might have been contemporary with Abraham or even Isaac. I'll explain why I think that in a moment, I guess. But based on internal evidence, we'd say this is probably northeast of Palestine. The word Uz can also double as a word for light sandy soil. So sort of the desert sands is part of the meaning of Uz as well. So Uz may or may not be where we think it is, but that's the general idea. So it's northeast of Palestine up in the upper Arabian Middle Eastern desert. What about the time period? Well, again, remember, if we're talking about that Uz, he was a son of Shem, and very likely before the time of Abraham, certainly, obviously, after the flood, everything was wiped out before, everything that existed before the flood was basically wiped out, and they started building cities again after the flood. But there are indications here that this was also before the law was given to Israel. And again, of course, people spread out from the ark after the flood, and they began to move out and began to inhabit farther regions of the earth. The language of the book of Job is Hebrew, but it has little splashes of Syriac and Aramaic. So the Syriac and Aramaic portions indicate that there was perhaps a dialect developing, but they were all still of a language within the Shem, or the Shemitic, which is where our Semitic word comes from. The Shemites were probably still speaking a language that is primarily Hebrew with additions. A Syriac and Aramaic, of course, were later going to become separate dialects. In Job 1 and verse 8, God says this to Satan. Job 1 verse 8, "Then the Eternal said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?" Now, when I read that, I find it hard to believe he was contemporary with Abraham. Job's life and Job's lessons and the book Job wrote are fantastically important for us and helpful to us. But Abraham is the friend of God, and Abraham is the one who received the promises and received the land, and from whom the blessings of Israel have flowed for 4,000 years. So we're not likely to find this as a part of a two-part righteous location here. Job is over here and Abraham's over here, and they're both the only righteous people around. We also don't find Job in the genealogies. So the time period is probably after the flood and maybe slightly before Abraham. What about Job himself? Some scholars like to believe that Job is not real. Job is fictitious. Job is an allegory. Job is just sort of there as a shadow person to make the lesson possible. And all the stories and everything are sort of constructed in order to come to a certain conclusion at the end, that Job wasn't a real person. He's just a person made up to present a story with a lesson. But what do we know about that? We know that the scriptures make clear that Job was a real person. We have his name used in various other places. In the book of Ezekiel, for example, let's look at two or three of these. Ezekiel chapter 14. I think I mentioned this one in passing a couple weeks ago. I didn't give you the sermon on Job, but I did touch on some of this material we were reading at the time. Ezekiel 14. And this comes from the word of the Lord, it says in verse 12. "The word of the Lord came again to me, saying, Son of man, when a land sins against me by persistent unfaithfulness, I will stretch out my hand against it. I will cut off its supply of bread, send famine on it, and cut off man and beast from it. Even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would deliver only themselves by their righteousness, says the Lord God." So if God says Noah, Daniel, and Job in the same sentence, and we know very well that Noah and Daniel are very real, isn't it quite obvious that Job is also real? And God's not talking about some fictitious character that somebody somewhere set up to create a lesson, or that God himself used to create a lesson. So Noah, Daniel, and Job are mentioned together. Now, if we go back to the New Testament, to the book of James, chapter 5, James chapter 5, verse 11. Well, let's start in verse 10. Verse 10. "My brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. Indeed, we count them blessed who endure. You have heard of the patience of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful." So James is clearly referring to Job and referring to his endurance, referring to his patience, and referring to God's blessing at the end of the thing. So there's no good reason to believe that Job is a figment of our imagination or is some kind of a literary figure just constructed for the purpose of creating a memorable lesson. Finally, we have the Apostle Paul in, I think this is 2 Corinthians, though I wrote down 1 Corinthians. Let me look. Either way, it's chapter 3. You can go take your chances. It's first. I have it written down right. Amazing. Didn't sound like the context. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 19. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. For it is written, quote, he catches the wise in their own craftiness, end quote. He catches the wise in their own craftiness. You know, if you look that up in a search on your search engine for the Bible, you know where you're going to find it? You're going to find it in the book of Job. You're going to find it in the book of Job in chapter 5 and verse 13. Let's go back there. Job chapter 5. When Paul says it is written, where is it written? Well, it's written in this fake book of Job. It's written in the book of Job. And Paul is quoting it like he quotes much of the rest of the Old Testament. Job chapter 5 and verse 13. He catches the wise in their own craftiness. Exact wording that Paul is quoting when he says it is written. So it's the only scripture where you're going to find that statement. So Job is real. Not only is Job real, Job apparently was a pretty amazing guy. Back to chapter 29 of the book of Job. Job 29. This is a little bit of a summary of Job's bio here, his biographical sketch, autobiographical in this case, in 29:7. When I went out to the gate by the city, when I took my seat in the open square, clearly a judgment seat, the young men saw me and hid. You don't want to get crosswise with Job. And the aged rose and stood. The princes refrained from talking and put their hand on their mouth. The voice of nobles was hushed, and their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouth. When the ear heard, then it blessed me. And when the eye saw, then it approved me, because I delivered the poor who cried out, the fatherless and the one who had no helper. The blessing of a perishing man came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind, and I was feet to the lame. I was a father to the poor, and I searched out the case that I did not know, looking for people to help. Verse 17, I broke the fangs of the wicked and plucked the victim from his teeth. So Job was a pretty powerful man. He was a pretty important man. He was a well-known man. He was respected. He was even feared. Perhaps not feared because of any oppressiveness or harshness, but feared because he apparently was wise enough and perceptive enough and capable enough and righteous enough to make some pretty severe judgments of people who were not doing what they ought to be doing, and he was certainly capable of taking care of people who needed help. So Job is, in a sense, a king. There's a place where he says that I was like, well, it's down at the end of the chapter, verse 25. I chose the way for them and sat as chief. So I dwelt as a king in the army, as one who comforts mourners. So Job was a very great, powerful man. All it says is he was the greatest man of the East. Well, if he's the greatest man of the East in both righteousness and in physical capacity and power, he's a pretty awesome person. You don't often have those two wrapped into one. David and Solomon being a couple of the few exceptions. Maybe in previous times, Abraham and some like, or not previous times, but in later times, people like Abraham and others. By Abraham, I meant previous to David and Solomon, not previous to Job. By the way, the book of Job, that is the actual book, the literature of the book of Job, is assumed by many, and probably rightly so, to be the oldest actual existing book in the world. The book of Genesis, of course, was written by Moses well after this time. The book of Genesis was written by Moses well after 400 years after Abraham's time. So you're talking about here a book that precedes everything that is probably written in book form that we know of in the world, and as I said last week, is inserted somewhere in the book of Genesis around chapter 11 and 12, right after the flood and before Abraham. So fascinating in that regard to read the book of Job. And I don't have time to go into some of the details, but some of the things you find fascinating, I'll just mention chapter 28 without going there. In Job 28, you find things similar to Psalm 104, where I often go to read about God's greatness and power when David is describing God as creator and all of the things he did. You read Job 28, and it's remarkable to see all the things that he talks about in terms of the silver and the gold, but also the sapphires and the topaz and the emeralds. And he talks about making mine shafts and people swinging by ropes and swinging back and forth to find the gold and the silver or the jewels. And he talks about taking light into mines so that they could work in the dark and make the darkness disappear, as he calls it. It's just amazing stuff. And you can read right through there and kind of miss it if you don't stop and think about it. All right, let's get to the lessons. Lesson number one, Satan has tremendous but limited power over man. We know how this all started in Job chapter 1. In Job chapter 1, I'll pick up just a little bit of this here. Verse 6, now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Eternal, and Satan also came among them. And the Eternal said to Satan, from where do you come? So Satan answered the Eternal and said, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth in it. Why was he doing that? Because he is the God of this world, because he was the appointed ruler of this world who had turned against God but was still on his throne, still in his place, to be ultimately replaced by Jesus Christ. But he is still walking to and fro on the earth. Then the Eternal said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil? We read earlier. So Satan answered the Eternal and said, does Job fear God for nothing? Job says, Satan says, yeah, sure, why shouldn't he? Does he fear you for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? So Satan very clearly knew who Job was. He knew that God was blessing him. He knew that God was protecting him. He knew that he really couldn't deal with Job because he was God's servant. You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now, stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. Notice, all that he has, not all that he is. Satan deals with the material world. And Satan wants to touch all that he has, thinking that because he is a materially well-off, obviously wealthy man, we didn't read all of his possessions, which don't mean as much to us today in terms of sheep and camels and horses and mules and all of those things, but he had a great deal, servants and houses and so forth. And the Eternal said to Satan in verse 12, and this is the important point here, behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on his person. So Satan went out from the presence of the Eternal. So Christ gives him permission to try Job and to try Job's righteousness, but he limits his authority and his power that he cannot touch his body. He cannot deal with his life. He can take his possessions, he can beat him up in various materialistic ways, but he cannot hurt him. And so Satan goes out, and of course, Satan begins to take things away. And I won't go into all that, you know it, if you've read it, and if you haven't, you should. But he begins to take away his possessions, his kids, his home, his camels, his donkeys. He begins to take things away from Job. And that's when we come to the place that I did read from Job, where he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will return there. The nothing in, nothing out principle we talked about last time. But in verse 22 of chapter 1, it says, in all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. So everything came crashing down around him. Now, as Christians today, what would we feel like if all of a sudden that happened to us? We've had brethren who lost their homes in a tornado, sometimes lost their business because of some unfair tactic on the part of banks or partners or tax people or whomever. We've had people whose lives have been in big trouble. You and I could be those people at any point in time. And this is a beautiful statement when it says, in all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. I think sometimes because we know about Job's self-righteousness, and that's the primary thing we normally think about when we talk about Job and we talk about the book of Job, we tend to think about Job in a negative. But Job is a very powerful man, not only in physical terms and the context in which he lived, but in his spiritual connection with God as well. His self-righteousness blinded him to some degree, but he was still a very righteous man. God did not say he was not righteous. The problem was he began to trust in his own righteousness to a certain degree. But he did not sin against God at this time. So then Satan comes back in chapter 2. Pick it up in verse 4. So Satan answered the Eternal and said, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. He's saying, okay, so Job weathered this, big deal. He's trying to save his life. Verse 5, but stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh. Now let's deal with his physical body. Let's deal with his pain and suffering and his feelings, his emotions. Well, we've already dealt with his emotions by taking away everything he had, but let's deal with his actual flesh. And he will surely curse you to your face. And the Eternal said to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life. Now he lets him go a little further to tempt and try and persecute Job, but he still puts limitations on him. Satan has limits on his power. And God says, you spare his life. So Satan went out from the presence of the Eternal. Now look what he does. Sometimes we wonder if Satan can do these things. It's very clear right here that he can. Satan went out from the Eternal and he struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. He made him physically sick. He created a terrible physical problem for Job, to the point that Job had to take a potsherd, you know, a broken piece of pottery, with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes, probably sitting in the ashes because they were soft and maybe a bit comforting, maybe even sort of blotted the runny boils. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Yeah, you think you're righteous and you've got this relationship with God, but what's the point? Look what's happened to you. Curse God and die. Now, that's the natural human reaction, I suppose, don't you? Now, that's the natural human reaction. If you're that kind of trouble, forget it. Just forget it. Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. So Job said, hey, you got to take the good times with the bad times with the good, as we would say, right? Job is saying, we take all these good things from God. God's given us everything we have. He seemed to understand that. Now God has given us adversity. Are we supposed to say, I'm bailing out of here. If you're not going to be good to me, I'm gone. So there's a lot of right principle and righteousness and judgment here in Job that we don't want to overlook. And when the three came to argue with him, of course, they came assuming that he couldn't be suffering this way if he wasn't a terrible sinner, or if he weren't a terrible sinner, properly said. Look in the New Testament, Luke chapter 13, verse 10. There are many of these examples. I'm just pulling this one out just because it kind of covers both sides of the picture here. But chapter 13, verse 10. Luke 13:10. Now he was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath, and behold, there was a woman who had a spirit of infirmity 18 years and was bent over and could no way raise herself up. Okay, sounds like a physical problem, all right. But when Jesus saw her, he called her to him and said to her, "Woman, you are loosed from your infirmity." And he laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made straight and glorified God. So Christ healed her, but it doesn't just say she had infirmity. It says also she had a spirit of infirmity. Well, you wonder sometimes. You go on down to the ruler of the synagogue in verse 14 complained because he did it on the Sabbath. Verse 15, the Lord answered him and said, "Hypocrite, does not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or donkey from the stall and lead it away to water?" The old ox in the ditch principle that we use. "So ought not this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound, think of it, for 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath?" So now it is not just a physical problem, although it may be a physical problem, but he says Satan did it. She's bound by Satan the devil for 18 years. And you're complaining because I'm loosing that burden and loosening that hold on her, that bondage, on the Sabbath day. The point being that Satan was still doing that kind of thing. He was binding people with physical maladies and difficulties, and we have no reason to believe he can't and might not do that today. The danger, of course, is to start to look at people and say, he must have let Satan bind him with this or that. You know, if you were looking at Job, you'd be like his three friends. Well, you know, even if Satan has affected some of us physically, he's done so with God's authority, but limited in power. Back to chapter 9, Luke 9. Keep it easy here. Luke 9, verse 37. Luke 9, 37. "Now it happened on the next day, when they had come down from the mountain, that a great multitude met him. Suddenly a man from the multitude cried out, saying, 'Teacher, I implore you, look on my son, for he is my only child.' And behold, the spirit seizes him, and he suddenly cries out. It convulses him so that he foams at the mouth, and it departs from him with great difficulty, bruising him. So I implored your disciples to cast it out, but they could not. Then Jesus answered and said, 'O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here.' And as he was still coming, the demon threw him down and convulsed him." Now, we have natural physical ailments in today's world that are not demon-possessed. People with various kinds of diseases. We think immediately, of course, of things like epilepsy and other kinds of seizures and things that can happen to people that seem to have physical causes. But this particular one was caused, my point being, by Satan through the demons. Then Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit, healed the child, and gave him back to his father. So the healing included rebuking the unclean spirit and sending him away and allowing the child to be free of the bondage that Satan had put him in. This is what he began to do to Job, and we're not given all the details, I'm sure, of everything that Job felt, though you can tell that he was about as miserable as a person can probably get. And still able to think, which God, of course, wanted him to be able to do. Now, from the time we get through Job chapter 2 there, Satan is never mentioned again in the book. There is one oblique reference to the destroyer, but it seems to be a general statement that doesn't really specifically refer to Satan himself. Satan is not referred to from this time forward. Now, moves to Job and his dealing with the problem and his friends and their unhelpful criticism until we get to Elihu, who helped him out. Both Job and his friends begin to consider the trial from Satan to be actually a punishment from God. As you read through it, they're considering that Job is under this terrible punishment, so he must have done something terribly wrong. He's defending his own righteousness, professing himself to be righteous, but how could he be in such terrible misery? Why would God have brought these things on him if he were righteous? So there's a little hint right there that we should be careful in our judgment not to always assume that we understand the cause and the effect in every case. Because in this case, Satan had asked to take on Job, and God had given him permission, but God was still in control, which is going to be our third point later. God gave Satan permission to work on Job, and Satan is the one who was doing the dirty deeds, not God. But God was going to use them for a purpose, as he often does for you and me. That's a different sermon, in a sense, on trials and what we learn from them. But we should learn something from how Job responded and how God worked with Job. So that's lesson number one, that Satan has tremendous but limited power over man. Lesson number two. Job defends himself based on his righteousness. Job defends himself based on his righteousness and integrity, which he has, but he does not give God credit for the character and the strength that he has. Instead, he sees God as treating him as a sinner and being unjust or unfair. And yet, he defends God's right to do that. Kind of an interesting, complex reaction, in a sense. Job thinks God is punishing me, even though I'm righteous. Why would God do that? God is not being like he's supposed to be. And yet he has the right to be whatever he wants to be. If God chooses to punish me, God has the right to punish me. But he's doing so when I haven't sinned, which is what some of his detractors said. They said, if you're not sinning, why would God be doing this to you? You obviously are sinning. Let's skip ahead here to chapter 35, where Elihu comes on the scene after the others have said their piece and basically condemned Job as an unrighteous man and concluded that doesn't have the integrity of heart that he says that he does. So, I always forget how to say their names. I have to look at them, but I won't right now. You know who they are if I stumble across them. Eliphaz or Eliphaz, I know, is one. Bildad is one. Having read the whole book, I still forget their names. Maybe that's supposed to happen. They're not particularly noteworthy. Chapter 35. I think we normally call this Elihu, though, in the with the L in front, which normally means God. It's probably Elihu, but Elihu comes on the scene, verse 35. Moreover, Elihu answered and said, "Do you think this is right?" What's he talking about? He's talking about Job's approach. Do you think this is right? Do you say my righteousness is more than God's? Do you say my righteousness is more than God's? For you say, what advantage will it be to you? What profit shall I have more than if I had sinned? See, even Elihu says, well, you're looking at it and saying, well, what's the point? What's the point in being righteous if I'm going to get this kind of treatment? What profit shall I have more than if I had sinned? I will answer you and your companions with you. Look to the heavens and see, and behold the clouds. They are higher than you. If you sin, what do you accomplish against him? You know, sin isn't going to change God. Or if your transgressions are multiplied, what do you do to him? It's all a human, short-term, temporal circumstance. If you are righteous, what do you give him? Does God need our righteousness if that's all it's about? If you are righteous, what do you give him? Or what does he receive from your hand? What does God say? He says, if I needed something, I wouldn't ask you. I don't need anything you have. Back in the Psalms. So he says, God doesn't really need your righteousness or your sin. Doesn't matter. It's all about what you get out of it. It's what you're going to ultimately come through it with. So we come down to verse 14. Although you say you do not see him, yet justice is before him, and you must wait for him. You must wait for him. And now, because he has not punished in his anger, nor taken much notice of folly, you know, God's not on a petty level of saying, ah, you did this, I'm going to slap you down. He has not punished in his anger, nor taken much notice of folly. Therefore, Job opens his mouth in vain. He multiplies words without knowledge. Job is thinking from a human perspective here, and he's sort of letting down on his understanding of his relationship with God. Remember the point I made earlier, self-righteousness blinds you. Self-righteousness blinds you from understanding God. I think that's actually why I stated number two in the first place. I probably didn't write it down properly here. Lesson number two is that self-righteousness prevents you from understanding God. That's what's happening here with Job. Going right on, 36, verse 1. Elihu also proceeded and said, bear with me a little, and I will show you that there are yet words to speak on God's behalf. Let's talk about who God is. I will fetch my knowledge from afar. I will ascribe righteousness to my Maker. That's pretty powerful. I will ascribe righteousness to my Maker. So he says, Job, if you think you're righteous, where does that leave God? If you think you're righteous and God is unfairly punishing you, where does that leave God? So Elihu begins to make some sense. And of course, later we find that God did not condemn Elihu for the things that he said. Well, we come to chapter 38, and as we know, God begins to speak. Chapter 38, and of course, this would be Christ. Chapter 38, verse 1, then the Eternal answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? So he sort of echoes what Elihu had said, that your knowledge is not right. I'm getting my knowledge from somewhere else. Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you and you shall answer me. I think not a place most of us would like to be. Suddenly facing God himself, who says, okay, as your King James might say, if you're reading it, gird up your loins like a man and give me an answer here. Let's talk about this man to man, face to face. What's happening here? Prepare yourself like a man. I will question you. You shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Now, God goes on through the next three or four chapters to describe his greatness and his power and his glory and the things that Job at that point in time cannot even begin to discern. Now, some would say today, well, we can discern some of these things now today through our scientific instruments. And, you know, we've come to the place where we're like they were at the Tower of Babel. Whatever we choose to do will not be restrained from us. And there's some truth in that. Some of the things that are posited to Job here, we would say, well, yeah, we kind of do know how that works today. And yet we really don't. We know how it works because we know that it's dependable and it's predictable because God made laws that govern it. And we can say, yes, we know it works this way. God even asked Job about the refraction of light, for example. Well, we can scientifically explain the refraction of light today, but we couldn't have made the law that makes it happen, could we? We couldn't have said light's going to refract this way at this angle. We couldn't have even made a physical law that says for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. You know, you throw a ball against a wall, it's going to come, well, some balls. You throw them against the wall, it's going to come back. There are laws in motion that govern how things work, and that's what God is presenting to Job here through these chapters. He begins to remind him that God is God, and that he has made it all, and that he has the understanding of it, and he has the power to work with it, and even to change it if he wants to. And he spends three or four chapters here explaining to Job that he has the creation under his care and judgment. Chapter 40, though, he, short term at least, he changes the subject. He comes back to it again in chapter 41, but in chapter 40, verse 1, moreover, the Eternal answered Job and said, shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? So we see a little bit of the problem. God says, Job, you are challenging me and correcting me. He who rebukes God, let him answer it. Then Job answered the Eternal and said, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will proceed no further. Job realized he was in deep water here. It wasn't a good time to smart off to God. Then the Eternal answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, and here it comes again, sort of the same kind of statement. Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you and you shall answer me. Would you indeed annul my judgment? God says, would you take away my perfect judgment? And why? The next line. Would you condemn me that you may be justified? That's the real kernel of truth here. That's the issue in terms of self-righteousness. It isn't that Job wasn't living a righteous life. Job had reached a point where now, because he's lived a righteous life and yet he seems to be paying penalties that would normally be brought upon for sin, God must be unfair because I'm righteous. You have to be wrong because I'm always right. We do that among ourselves sometimes, don't we? You have to be wrong because we disagree and I'm always right. Well, in this case, Job was doing that with God. You must be wrong because I'm right. And God says, would you, and this is the key to it, would you indeed annul my judgment, would you condemn me that you may be justified? Pretty powerful question that Job really didn't have much opportunity to come back with. Chapter 42, verse 1. Then Job answered the Eternal and said, I know that you can do everything, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. Something we always ought to remember. You can do everything, and no purpose of yours will be withheld from you. God says, all my counsel will stand. I will fulfill all my will, my purpose. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? That cut Job to the quick. He says, therefore I have uttered what I did not understand. He doesn't try to defend himself now. Things too wonderful for me, which I didn't know. Listen, please, and let me speak. Now he's humbling himself. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. And here's his answer. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Probably where the term seeing is believing comes from. You know, most of these proverbs and sayings come eventually from the scripture. Now my eye sees you. I've heard of you with the hearing of the ear, but I didn't have full understanding. Now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. Wow. I abhor myself. No longer is Job saying, wait a minute, I'm righteous. My integrity is with me. I defend my position. God is judging me unjustly. He's saying, you have the right and the power and the option to judge me any way you want. You're God. I'm nobody. I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. And I guess in Job's case, that was pretty easy. He was already in the ashes, wasn't he? He repented in dust and ashes, and that's a symbolic experience in that sense. Lesson number 3. God is always in control and is perfectly just. God is always in control and is perfectly just. Remember, back in chapter 2, verse 6, the Eternal said to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life. The first point was that Satan is limited, but this one actually, in a sense, tells us how he's limited. He's limited because God has all power. God has all control. God is in authority. God is going to do what he will do. So he gives Satan a certain freedom, but he puts a box around it and says you shouldn't go outside these lines. As he had done in the first place, he does here, but this one has to do with sparing his life. Keep that in mind. Let's go back to chapter 40. Chapter 40 and verse 9. God is still carrying out his purpose and his will. And here in chapter 40, when he's talking to Job, picking up where we left off, I come back to this point, because God is explaining to Job and describing to Job what Job would have to be if he were really equal to God, if he were really like God, if he were really as righteous as God, if he were really as just as God, if he were really as powerful as God, would he be able to do these things? Job 40, beginning verse 9. Right after he says, would you condemn me that you may be justified? He says, have you an arm like God? Or can you thunder with a voice like his? Then adorn yourself. In other words, okay, if you can, the assumption here is that Job is saying, sure. So if you can, then adorn yourself with majesty and splendor and array yourself with glory and beauty. Disperse the rage of your wrath. Look on everyone who is proud and humble him. Could Job do that? You know, Job was this great king. We read about it. He was this great king. He had all his power. People feared him. But could he humble somebody in the sense that the person became humble? Look on everyone who is proud and humble him. Look on everyone who is proud and bring him low. Tread down the wicked in their place. Hide them in the dust together. Bind their faces in hidden darkness. Then I will also confess to you that your own right hand can save you. See, God is saying, if you can do all of these things, if you're so great and you can do all these things, well, then I will also confess to you that your own right hand can save you. You have what it takes. But by this time, of course, Job was recognizing, I don't. I don't have what it takes. God is in charge. God is in control. And God says, you cannot save yourself. But God is seeking for Job to understand himself and to understand God, and of course, ultimately, no doubt, to also understand Satan the devil and his role. But after Job sees God's righteousness and repents in dust and ashes, God again demonstrates his power to do anything he chooses, and of course, in this case, to save Job, and not only to save Job, but to restore Job. So in chapter 42, we pick it up in verse 7. After Job says in verse 6, therefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. Verse 7, and so it was after the Eternal had spoken these words to Job that the Eternal said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is aroused against you and your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. God says to these guys who waxed eloquent over and over and over again about Job's sin and how he was hiding something from them. He had secret sins that God was punishing him, and yet he was pretending to be righteous. No, God says, he is righteous. He spoke what was right about me. You did not. The only problem Job has was he made me unjust in order that he would be justified. That part wasn't right, and God's already covered that with Job, and Job has repented. But he says, you didn't speak right of me. Now, therefore, take for yourselves 7 bulls and 7 rams, go to my servant Job, and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering. Again, interesting in the light that this was before the law, this was before the sacrificial system, and yet there were animals being offered up as sacrifice, as we find in other early places in civilization. So some of those things came before the law, and then were later added and structured because Israel would not obey the law. But notice, offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept him, lest I deal with you according to your folly, because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. That happened, remember, with Abraham. People had to go back and ask Abraham to pray for them. Even after he sinned, they also sinned. And God said, yes, but he's my prophet, and I know him, and he's my friend. You go ask him to pray for you, and I'll hear you, in the case of the Gentile kings. Verse 9, so Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar the Naamathite went and did as the Eternal commanded them, for the Eternal had accepted Job. I'm sure you all knew the answer already if I had asked you who's the shortest man in the Bible, right? Who's the shortest man in the Bible? You all know. I just told you. Bildad the Shuhite. Shortest man in the Bible. And the Eternal restored Job's losses when he prayed for his friends. Indeed, the Eternal gave Job twice as much as he had before. Again, this is obviously for effect, for emphasis, for those of us who need to learn the lesson. God has the power to do that. Gave him twice as much as he had before. Then all his brothers, all his sisters, and all those who had been his acquaintances before, people who had, by the way, fled from him. Remember, Job described how they no longer will even talk to him. They don't even look at him. They don't like him anymore. When he was great and powerful and rich and taking care of everybody and comforting people, everybody loved him, apparently. At least they respected him. Now they won't even talk to him. Now it says they came back. Oh, Job's rich again. I think I'll go talk to him. All his brothers, all his sisters, all those who had been his acquaintances before came to him and ate food with him in his house, and they consoled him and comforted him for all the adversity that the Eternal had brought upon him. So God allowed him to have restored support and friendship from those people, even who had been fickle enough to forsake him in time of need. Each one gave him a piece of silver and each a ring of gold. Now the Eternal blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning. For he had 14,000 sheep. It was 7 in the beginning, and all of these are doubled, as you know. 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 female donkeys. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters, which he had before. He gets his sons and daughters not back, but replaced by 7 and 3 once again. And he names them here, the daughters. Verse 15, in all the land were found no women so beautiful as the daughters of Job. So he didn't just give him back daughters. He gave him beautiful daughters that were obviously well appreciated and respected. And their father gave them an inheritance among their brothers. So they also became rich. After this, Job lived 140 years and saw his children and grandchildren for 4 generations. So Job died old and full of days. Now, I think it would be fair to speculate that since Job lived another 140 years, pretty obvious that this is the period of time in which he wrote all this down. Wrote down the history, wrote down the lessons, wrote down his own sad experience, documented for all the rest of us what really happens when you are self-righteous and when you forget who God is. And when Satan the devil decides he wants to prove that he's powerful by picking on God's people. If God lets him, he lets him in limited ways, and he will ultimately restore. But it's very likely that Job then put the story together, and it may not be, as critics would say, and I would have to agree with them, it may not be word for word the way it was said. It has certain poetic value and structure and so forth that Job probably put together as you would put together something you write after the fact in terms of an autobiography or a story or a play of some sort. He put it together not only in the factual sense that it's accurate, but in the sense that it appears almost as a structured debate, which ultimately only God wins. The language would seem to indicate that. 3 lessons from Job that we would do well to learn and remember. And if you haven't read the book lately, if you're not reading the Bible reading program, then you will maybe one of these days soon be reading the book of Job. And I hope you will see in it and draw from it these lessons of life that seem extremely valuable from my reading and from God's obvious perspective and putting it in the Bible. It's among the Hebrew and Jewish literature and the canon of the Bible, even though it far preceded, or at least preceded, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all of Judaism. So God put it there because it's a historic account of a righteous man, singly apparently at that point obeying God, being attacked by Satan the devil, and being delivered because God is in control. God is in charge, and God has proven once and for all in that document that Satan is limited, that Satan is going to be overcome, that God is not going to allow him to destroy what he is doing, that all his purpose will stand.